Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 9 of The Edict. This week, we've got a bit of a treat for you. We'll be doing a deep dive on Dinrovatron, with none other than the deck's most synonymous pilot and winner of two challenges on the deck, Birdman, also known as Entropy 263 on MTGO. In addition to this podcast, we will have a companion primer on the Dinrovatron deck written by the two of us, and that'll be found up on our very under-construction website, castleofcommons.com. You can find the podcast up there, and that's sort of where we're putting a bunch of our content in the near future, including primers and that sort of thing. So with all that out of the way, let's get on to this week's Royal Decree. All right, so we're here talking about Tron, and specifically Dinrovatron with Birdman Entropy 65, I believe it is.
It's 263.
263, my mistake. So what kind of got you into Pauper in the first place? Like, what was your introduction to the format?
So my introduction to the format was my first Magic Online deck. I was actually still a high school student then, so I didn't have a whole lot of money. This is before my first job. So I went the cheap route, and back then it was Pauper. I picked up Mono Blue Control. Not Delver, but Control.
Control?
Yeah, it was basically...
It's been a minute since I've seen that around.
You ran a playset of Excludes. Your creature base was 4 Delver, 4 Spire Golem, and then everything else is either Counter Magic or Cantrip.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things we've kind of seen fall off a lot, is those sort of... like teaching style, old school kind of control decks, right? We don't really see that floating around our meta too much. It's really been replaced with sort of our deck du jour today, the Tron list as sort of the more hard control list. So what kind of got you involved with Tron, and specifically Dinrovatron?
So around the Drake era, I played for a bit, and I had quit just because it got stale pretty for a while. And then when I came back to Pauper, I was looking for control decks because Mono Blue Control had died. I tried playing it a bit, but Gurmag Angler was a beating when your only removal is Piracy Charm and you try to run Repeal on Gurmag Angler. It doesn't really work too well. So I looked to alternatives of control, and I found Tron, and I fell in love with casting Pulse of Murasa on Mnemonic Wall 15 times in a game.
Yeah, Pulse of Morasses was probably easily one of the cards that got me the most excited about Pauper, like in recent memory. I was sort of tangentially involved in the format, then I saw this as like, ooh, that's going to be real good with some of the synergies in some of these other decks here. So kind of brought me back down to the format to kind of check things out, and I haven't left since. So beyond like Tron decks, is there any other decks in the format you like to favor or play a lot of other than that?
I actually am the progenitor of the current other tap out or draw go control deck of blue red. That is my project, and I do enjoy playing that one quite a bit. It's still along the themes of control. You'll probably never see me on aggro or tempo, though. I'm a big control guy.
No, you're not a stompy fan?
Not one bit. I've tried them, and I just cannot get behind them. I've never been able to play more than a single league online with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. I've always had trepidations about the combat step. It always kind of feels weird to me to be using my creatures that way. You know, it's just not natural for me. So flipping back over towards Dinrovatron, what would you define as the core synergistic parts of the deck? Like, what is the engine that makes the whole thing run as a deck?
So when it boils down to it, the core of the deck is Mnemonic Wall, Ghostly Flicker, and Pulse of Murasa. The rest of the deck just facilitates taking advantage of that core or getting to that core, because there's not a whole lot of decks. Once you establish two walls flicker, there's not much anybody else can do. And then on the flip side of when people are trying to stop you from establishing two walls on flicker, Pulse of Murasa loops Mnemonic Wall through their removal infinitely. So that's your main source of winning.
While simultaneously gaining you life to avoid aggro or anything like that. So yeah, it's such a powerful deck, I find, in terms of how it can just keep going. Like, it doesn't really ever hit a lot of road bumps. Either you take me out of the game before I get any sort of mana going at all, or I'm almost impossible to stop, right? So you kill a combo piece, I get it back with Pulse. If you try and blow something up with targeted removal, I can just flicker it to avoid that, you know? There's just so many ways that the deck kind of can restart that engine, even if you try and disrupt it or get in there and mess things up. It's a really powerful, inevitable engine at the core of the deck. So you alluded a little bit before about some of the cards that sort of get you to that engine part, like that allow you to set that up. And I think one of the big things that people know the deck for is Moments Piece, and that being like the core fog type effect in the deck. But it's one of those cards that we don't really see a lot of in Tron. We only see two of it in most lists. So maybe you could talk a little bit about why that number comes up like that and why that card is so useful to a deck like Dinrova Tron.
So Moments Piece is a card that I have a love-hate relationship with. There was a while there where I was known for running exactly one copy in my main deck because I dislike seeing that card in my hand. It is a necessary evil, as when it's in your hand and you're not ready to cast it, it's actually just a dead card. When you're winning, it's a dead card. When you're trying to pull ahead, it's a dead card. But when your opponent is attacking for 12 power and you don't have 12 life, it's the best card in your deck. So you want it as a teachings target to where you can find it when you need it, but you absolutely never want to draw it and have it in your opening hand. So you want to run as little copies as you feel like you can get away with.
Mm-hmm. That's sort of the double-edged sword of a lot of these fog type cards, right? Is that it really does absolutely nothing to make you win better or to more often get to that point in the game where you can snowball it. It's not like a rejuvenation elf or anything like that, where you're pushing your land base ahead. You're not ramping. You're not drawing cards with it. It's literally just, if I don't have this in my deck, I will die to aggressive decks. So it's got to be there, but it's not really helping in a lot of ways.
Exactly.
So one of the things that I kind of had a bit of a revelation on, you sort of touched on a little bit with the mystical teachings part, is that the deck sort of gets to cheat a little bit by running a whole bunch of effects that it needs as a 4 of, but it doesn't have to run as a 4 of, because it can run Mystical Tutor instead. And what that lets it do is it lets it, because it's a Tron deck, right? Tron gets to not care about how much things cost because it's playing Tron lands. So by saying, I get to run these spells that are effectively two more copies of anything I need, but they cost 4 more, but I don't care about that 4 more because I'm Tron, is sort of a, I don't want to call it like an unfair advantage, but it sort of feels like you're cheating whenever you use that kind of synergy that way.
Yeah, Mystical Teachings is a card that I think the Tron decks would be significantly weaker without. Especially Dinrova Tron, as you'll see me run like one or two copies of so many cards that you want in the right time, but you never really want to draw them. So you rely on the power of teachings, as you'll see me run only two counter spells, only two fogs, stuff like that. That if I didn't have teachings, I'd have to have run more copies of them, and it would hurt my overall consistency, which Tron is already kind of lacking in the first place.
Yeah, it's sort of one of those, how few copies of each different effect can I run before I start stumbling on finding them when I need them, right? And the deck runs a lot of dig, right? And it has a lot of ways to repetitively dig, especially once the engine gets going, you know? We can play games like Flickering Double Flicker Mauldrifter, or Flicker a Mauldrifter and a Wall, and just keep doing that to draw two cards for 3 mana every turn kind of thing, right? So because it has so much dig, you can afford to run less of the spells that matter. So it's one of those kind of weird decks that I don't want to call it like a Xeroxy style, but it certainly has that sort of element to it where we run the best cards in the deck, but they might be situationally worse in some places.
It reminds me of the Glittering Wish sideboards, but instead of it being in our sideboard, it's kind of in our main deck, and we use teachings instead of a wish card.
Yeah, it's sort of that same kind of thing of like, I want these silver bullets, but I can't always afford to give up game one if I don't have them. So we just run so few of them that we don't see them when we don't need them, and we can go looking for them when we do. So yeah, it's definitely a a very powerful card that lets the deck be more consistent than it has really any right to be. So following that, what would you say is the essential parts of a keepable hand for Denrovatron? Like, I'm sitting down for the first time playing Denrovatron. I pick up my first seven. What am I looking for? What am I looking to have in that opening?
So ideally, you see Tron in it with a Prophetic Chrism, but we don't always live in that world. So a lot of the times what I'm looking for, there's kind of two keepable hands. Is a hand that has a path to two Tron lands, whether that's a single Tron land and an expedition map or just two Tron lands naturally. I'll usually keep those hands if they have any sort of game actions within the first three or four turns, like Prophetic Chrism or Signet or something. Those hands are usually keeps. The other hands that I keep will be a hand that only has one land, one Tron land, but it has a Signet Muldrifter. Turn four Muldrifter is a very powerful turn, even if you don't have Tron, and those are usually worthwhile keeping. Now, if you know what your opponent is on, there's a whole lot more that we can go down there, but against a blind opponent, those are typically the two things I look for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, get those early game actions, and I think that's one of the key things to be thinking about when you're playing the deck is how many game actions can I get in per turn, right? Like, how many times can I use Flicker? How many times can I generate some sort of advantage on my turn or on your turn before I untap, right? So I think that's a really big part of how the deck operates and how it is so efficient. Like, I was watching your streams the other day while I was doing some research for the primer we're writing, and it's one of those kind of things of, like, it always feels like a chain of dominoes, right? Like, well, I have this, which gets me to this, which is what I need to do this thing, and then if I have that piece, I can go over here and draw two more cards. If I draw those two more cards, I can dig a little bit deeper, and maybe I can find the thing I need, right? And it always kind of feels like you're trying to snowball enough dominoes together to get where you need every turn.
Yeah, a lot of the time it's like that. With Tron, it's almost, you're not really playing against an opponent. You're playing against a predetermined time of they're going to kill you unless you do this. It doesn't really matter what your opponent is doing. So you're kind of just trying to assemble your own game plan there. And it's typically what you look for in your hands because you do want to have the best chance of assembling that game plan.
So we've had some pretty drastic meta shifts in Pauper fairly recently. A lot of that is related to the downshift of foil and the rise of Blue-Black Delver. So before all of that really came into play, how would you feel Tron matched up against a lot of the decks before that happened?
So before that happened was obviously the time where I won my two challenges in a row, which is probably the high point of my career. And that was actually just before the Blue-Black Delver came up, and I would say I felt very favored. Now, favored isn't necessarily like I'm winning every match because my deck is so broken. In fact, a lot of matchups I believe were around 50%, like Blue-Red Delver. I felt like a lot of the times it was up to who was the better player, and sometimes up to who drew better. So overall, I felt like Tron was a very solid deck that I could play as Old Faithful, that I would always know I stood a chance against the metagame.
Mm. And I really would say that's sort of one of the great things about Tron, is that I felt, at least before the current meta, that I always had at least, it wasn't always 50%, but it always felt like close to that or better against a lot of decks. I always felt like I had a chance. There was always, if I draw in this certain way, or if I hit this card now or over the next couple turns, I'll be okay. And I definitely would say that those kind of games have tapered off a lot. Would you say you feel the same way about the way the meta's been shifting?
Yeah, with the way the meta's shifted, so Blue-Black Delver kind of puts Tron in a really hard spot. Before, there were decks that you wanted Fog against because they were too fast for you to play a control game against. And then there are decks you didn't want Fog against. But Blue-Black Delver kind of presents a strange situation where sometimes you do want the Fog because they put pressure but they don't have counter magic. And then sometimes Fog is just a horrible card because they're going to try and put the squeeze hold on you to where you can't resolve any card advantage. And it's also just one of those decks. So before Blue-Black Delver came around, I was always saying that Tron is, because it's a five-color teachings deck, you can tech it for any deck within the metagame. And then Blue-Black Delver rolled around, and I tried and I tried and I tried, and I never found that sideboard configuration that just made me feel like, if I devote this much to this deck, I can beat them. I never did find that balance, and that's kind of took a pretty big hit on Tron, I think.
Yeah, I would definitely say that the deck's in a much weaker position than it was previously. It definitely feels like there are a lot of games against Blueback Delver where I feel pretty much from the first two turns, I can't win this game anymore. It's basically over at this point. They're too far ahead of me. They've got too much on board right now. I can't stop them enough, right? And I would say that that wasn't really true about very many decks before. Like, there was some hands out of Stompy where I felt like, yeah, this is just lethal on turn four. I can't catch up to this. I can't outpace them. I'm not drawing well, that kind of thing. But I would definitely say that the consistency with which Blue-Black Delver is able to create that situation where I know I'm dead factually before it happens is much higher than it used to be with a lot of other decks in the meta. Not to harp on Blue-Black Delver very much, but where would you feel that your percentage is against them right now? Just rough ball.
I would probably say around 40 to 45%. I've made a lot of concessions to that matchup, and I still haven't gotten it to 50%. More often than not, that's the games where you draw Tron, I feel favored, but it's those games where you don't draw Tron is where you're looking to shore up, and I haven't had much success there.
I know what you're running right now is the Oracles build, like the Seagate Oracles build with the Tron deck. Did you feel it was any better in those matchups with the Elvish Rejuvenator, or is that more tech for other matchups?
So when I did run Elvish Rejuvenator, I think that actually improves the matchup quite a bit, but what I ran into was every other matchup decreases significantly because Rejuvenator just doesn't get a card when you need it to. It's also just a 1-1, so when you do run into the stray, not Blue-Black Delver, but Mono Blue or Blue-Red, and they play a Ninja and you're sitting at a Rejuvenator on board, you're pretty upset that you're running that card. And I just, at the end of the day, I didn't believe it was worth it to improve my Blue-Black Delver matchup by, say, 5% to decrease all of my other matchups by possibly 5% as well.
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't say the field is at this point so homogenous that that's a good idea just yet. But I would definitely say, like, maybe if your local meta is more homogenous that way, of you've got three people and they're all playing Blue-Black Delver every week, and you have maybe one or two other decks that are playing locally, then yeah, maybe switch over that way. But for the online meta where I believe most of us play, I think it's better to stick on the Seagate Oracle plan, because I feel like the floor on Seagate Oracle is much higher than it is on Rejuvenator. Because even if you don't get anything great off Oracle, it is still just a much better body for our format right now than a lot of other decks are against the wider meta.
Yeah, exactly. If the format was so dominated by Blue-Black Delver, I'd definitely be on Rejuvenators, and I did try them for a while, but Seagate Oracle is a much safer and a much more consistent choice to go for.
So the other big deck that's kind of risen to popularity recently is Boros Bully. Now, I'm curious, just as an opener, how do you feel you're fared against Boros Bully in the current meta? I know, personally, I feel a lot worse against it than I did against the Boros Monarch decks that used to be running around.
So I actually think the Bully matchup, let's assume they're not running Flaring Pain in their sideboard first, and then we'll assume after. So if they're not on Flaring Pain, I believe it's a whole lot easier than Boros Monarch. They don't present lethal till around turn 5 if they've got a great hand, turn 6 on an average hand, which gives you 6 turns to establish Tron and find a Fog. They don't run Burn like Boros Monarch, so you can safely go to 4 life and start casting Moments Piece and feel great. So 6 turns when your deck is designed to have the Fog by turn 4 sometimes, I would say, is a fantastic matchup.
Now, you feel very favored into them?
I feel incredibly favored versus them. Now, if they have Flaring Pain, that presents a problem, because if they present lethal on turn 6 with Flaring Pain backup, you're probably not beating them, but it's usually only one or two Flaring Pain. So let's say turn 8 to turn 9, you have to have your Fog with 2 pieces of counter magic up, which is doable, but it's a whole lot more to ask for, and I would say it probably puts us at, like, let's say 70% game one, and then 40% post-board where they have 2 Flaring Pains.
Yeah, and that's quite a swing for the deck, right? I would say that's one of the bigger swings you get from a deck that is not Boggles, basically, which is where the other location I usually see Flaring Pain. I sometimes get it out of Affinity, but that's basically the only other place I see it.
Flaring Pain by itself isn't so much of the issue. It's the Flaring Pain with Pyroblast backup that Tron finds a hard time to deal with.
Because we can usually establish at least one or two counters. We don't run a ton of them, especially in the Derover builds. Like the Marasa builds, it's much more of a conventional control package with a number of counters and a number of removal pieces and that sort of thing. But we don't really run a heck of a lot of removal pieces at all, really. And we run a couple counters just to sort of hit those high impact spells. But yeah, I would definitely say Flaring Pain is a kicker in that matchup where it can be supported so strongly by other cards in the deck. So yeah, you would say your matchup against Boros Monarch is significantly worse, or not necessarily significantly, but enough of a worse matchup that it's noticeable to you between the two decks?
It's incredibly noticeable. I'm pretty good at drawing out the Galvanic Blast to my opponents. It's not very often I don't see three Galvanic Blasts on top of a couple bolts in a game. So when I don't have to worry about dying from 12 life, I think I'm going to go ahead and say it's probably a 10% difference in win rate. Now, I'm still favored against Boros Monarch, but Bully feels quite a bit easier when you can just fog six on turn six and feel you've won the game.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the biggest strengths of the Boros Monarch deck is being able to say, all I really have to do is half health you. And then after that, I can just, windmill slam three burn spells over the course of a turn, and you'll probably die to that. Right? And that's sort of one of the aspects of the deck that gives it that staying power, even when decks like Boros Bully are still around in the meta, that it can just triple Galvablast you or something like that, right? So that's sort of what keeps it in the running. How do you feel about the like artifact draw package in Boros Monarch against the Tron deck? Like how much concern do you feel when you see, like the second Core Skyfisher come down and bounce to the artifact, that kind of thing, right?
So a lot of the times I'm more scared of the second Skyfisher in turn three bouncing my land than I am concerned of them drawing a card, because our card draw is just leagues ahead of theirs, that if we want them to actively be spending 4 mana and 3 mana to play a cantripping creature instead of just playing it out for pressure, because that just gives us so much more time because we're drawing more cards than them and our game plan ends the game instead of just getting incremental advantage. So we're usually happy when we see that.
Yeah, that's definitely been my experience too, is that when you see how slowly they're drawing cards and you're like, well, okay, I'll evoke Moldrifter and then I'll just flicker it and that's 6 mana and I've drawn 4 cards, and you're spending a similar amount to play like 2 creatures out and draw a couple cards, like I'm never super concerned about that plan, and I definitely like seeing that for my opponents, them playing out those slower lines in Monarch. So yeah, moving beyond on those two lists, is there anything else that you really feel is like the format's big bad menace when you're sitting down to play Tron? Like you go into a league and you're like, I really hope I don't hit this 3 times.
So right now I'd say that menace is Blue-Black Delver, because I can't build to beat them. So I'm always going to feel unfavored versus them. But a lot of the times the deck that is usually considered Tron's menace is red deck wins, not burn, but the creature build. Because Burning Tree Emissary and Bushwhacker typically just put too much pressure on us, and we're at a very low life total. By the time we do find the fog, they've got a Fire Blast to finish us off, and it just feels like a pretty rough matchup. It's still winnable, but I'm never happy to run into it.
Yeah, the combination of Stompy's best line plus also having Fire Blast backup is a really, really strong play that deck can really kind of manifest if it lines up correctly. I definitely say it's a little bit less consistent than Stompy in the aggro deck side of things, but it's certainly formidable when you happen to run into it, and that's definitely something I've had a few games taken off me because of. So beyond that, one of the things I kind of want to get at is just overall, how do you feel a player can improve with Denorvotron? Like they're familiar with the format, they know what the decks are, they sit down like, I wanna get good at Denorvotron. I wanna be the next Birdman on Twitch. How do I become that, right?
So because it has a teachings package, there's a lot of play to Tron. A lot of it is recognizing the lines that are good, which takes practice, but the best way to start recognizing lines, let's say we have infinite clock and I always want to make the correct play, get good at reading opponent what your opponent has, not what necessarily you have and what you can do, but what your opponent has and what you can do. When your opponent's leaving up two mana, what are they doing? When your opponent plays this instead of, like, let's say they play a Ponder turn two and leave up one mana instead of an Augur Bolas or something, what do they have? Being able to reliably answer those questions and spot four out of maybe six cards in your opponent's hand is a skill that Tron can definitely capitalize, because they have such a toolbox of responses. And if you can read your opponent and cast teachings on turn four, knowing that you're getting the perfect spell to counter their hand, that is where you improve your percentages.
I think definitely also the speed at which you can execute through the different steps. Like, if you're going to tutor, don't spend very long doing it. You should, by the time you're casting Mystical Tutor, you should already know where you're going into the deck to get, and it should just take very, very little time to go in and grab that. I see a lot of people, you know, they pop down Mystical Tutor, then it just sits there, and they're looking, and they're looking, and they're looking, and they're looking, and then they find the card and go get it, right? It's definitely a deck that you really want to maximize the amount of time you have available to you, because it's not a fast deck. It is a control deck. It's going to take a long time to win. You don't want to be pushing yourself for time any more than you have to be. So I would definitely say getting fast at pretty much every aspect of the deck is one of the first things I pushed myself to do when I was picking it up. And I think that any new player should really do the same kind of thing, is just get fast. Be able to go through all the steps very quickly.
On that same note, Ghostly Flicker Loops, if you feel that you are slow at it and that you're timing out very often, don't feel embarrassed to just hop into solo play mode and practice your Ghostly Flicker Loops over and over. I haven't timed out in a very long time, but it takes a lot of practice to be able to do it quickly, and it pays off, because the faster you are with your flickers, the more time you have to spend, or you can spend, on thinking about your plays that changes the percentages instead of timing out because you had to think too long.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely one of those decks is that if you are going to the tank to focus on doing your combo in the fastest order, you're not thinking enough about what your opponent's doing, what their deck does, how do you interact with their deck, right? You definitely want all that stuff to be as muscle memory as you can possibly make it be, so that you don't have to worry at all about the actual execution of the play. You can focus on thinking about how your deck works and how you can interact with their deck. I definitely think that's one of the biggest skills a Tron player can cultivate. So following that, one of the things I kind of want to get into is, what do you, like, you mentioned it's a toolboxy style deck, right? What are some of the things that you've tested in the past? What are some of the things that you tune up the deck with and play around with that kind of move those percentages around a little bit for you?
So a lot of it, Denovatron not so much as the control variants, but there's still some play. Like, I only run two pieces of counter magic, but in the past there's been lists that run like 3, 4, 5, 6, different amounts on that. There's also the Ghostly Flicker count. You can run cap size instead of your second Ghostly Flicker, stuff like that. The fog. I'm probably the only person who's ever played one fog, but I'm a pretty big advocator for it if it's not a very aggro heavy meta. That's mainly it that blue green Tron in specific runs. Your sideboard has a lot of options, but at the end of the day, it's just going to be Pyro Hydro as far as teachings targets for the most part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the being able to run both of those is kind of one of the big strengths of Tron, is that you really don't have to actually step into those colors to be able to pull off a Pyroblast, be able to pull off a Hydroblast, right? So being able to put four of each of those into the deck, I think, is really, really powerful in the sideboard.
Yeah, it's definitely a big boon that you get to run four of each best sideboard card in the format.
Yeah. Speaking of sideboard cards, what are some of your favorite ones that you would say are particularly tuned towards certain matchups?
So I'm not currently on one, but in a Tron-heavy meta, I'm always a fan of the Bojuka Bog sideboard, as well as I love Silver Bullets like that. Serrated Arrows is also a personal favorite of mine that I've always loved. That's mainly just because I've been in Pauper a long time, and it's always just been by my side. Back when I played Mono Blue Control, I ran it, so more of a pet card than just a fantastic card. It's still good in Tron sideboards, but it's got some personal value there.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of my favorite cards, because like you said, I remember playing Acid Trip back in the day. I remember playing different control decks that ran it. It was always been sort of one of those cards that's been involved with Pauper. It's sort of a little bit of a weird old card that you don't really see in any of the other formats. So it's a bit unique towards Pauper, so that's certainly nice. The other thing that kind of makes at least those two cards especially good is in Tron specifically is your ability to play around with them with Flicker, right? Because you're able to repetitively Bajuka Balk your opponent every turn if you want to with a Flicker Loop setup, or the same thing with your arrows. You can just keep setting that up with more and more counters on it to keep expending.
Exactly. There's not much. It's a pretty satisfying feeling having Mnemonic Wall, Ghostly Flicker on your serrated arrows. Feels very satisfying gunning down elves with your arrows.
Yeah, fairy is anything, really. That's another deck I kind of want to talk to you about, because I would say that's one of the other big decks that can kind of show up and really put up results, and that's elves. How do you feel against that matchup, and how do you feel the meta has changed elves in relation to Tron, if at all?
So elves and Tron, it's a pretty strange matchup. So right now, elves players seem to be running four melodies, which is probably what you're afraid of, because it finds your longbow more consistently. You don't really remove your opponent's elves game one. And I'd probably say it's somewhere between scarier than Stompy, because they present lethal just slightly slower, but they have a way to kill you through your fog lock, but not as scary as Blue-Black Delver, because I still feel pretty okay against them. Usually the games you lose are where they present lethal on turn four or turn five, and then they follow it up with a melody for six or seven cards the turn after and find longbow. But you have access to Electricker in the sideboard. You have access to Serrated Arrows. So it's not a deck that, if you're expecting it, you can beat it.
Mm-hmm. It definitely has those sideboard options that we can plug in, right? If you know there's an Elves player in your LGS, you know that you're going to be running into an Elves player in the upcoming challenge. It's a deck that you can put the things in to beat those decks. And I would say that's true of quite a few decks in our meta, except for some of the top ones. I think that they are some of the top decks because they don't have those type of cards that just hose them so completely that can be played in multiple decks.
Yeah, and even a step further, if you're expecting to play against 30-40% of Elves players in your tournament, you can easily main deck Electricker due to our teachings package, which is a pretty powerful tool to have against game one Elves.
Yeah, being able to, quote-unquote, tutor up your sideboard cards is extremely powerful for the deck to be able to do, and I think that's one of the biggest incentives of running stuff like Hydro and Pyroblast, is because they can just be found when you need them, right?
Yeah, it's the cards are a whole lot more powerful when you can have them at any moment once you hit four mana.
So one more kind of question about what you're looking for in the deck. What does a win look like? Like, what does a victory in like game one, for example, look like on turn four? Like, how have things progressed from our opening hand to that point?
So I think turn four is probably going to be a hard turn to justify, but a lot of the times when your turn four Muldrifter resolves, you feel pretty comfortable, but your win doesn't happen for a long time usually. So turn four is kind of a hard ask there.
You can pick another turn if you want, if that's easier, right?
When I feel like I have won, it's when I'm making plays that my opponent can't deal with. So let's say I'm up against a deck with counter magic and I resolve Mnemonic Wall. I feel like I've won. The game's probably not ending for another five turns, but my Mnemonic Wall is on the table. I got back a spell. I feel like I've won. If it's against like Stompy, I'm looking at a chain that's going to get me to the fog lock, guaranteed. I don't have any question about it. I feel like I've won. So it's a lot of those, like, if you see a path towards your wall combo, you can feel like you have won. That usually happens around turn six or so.
Mm-hmm. A little bit further down the road than a lot of other decks feel like they've kind of solidified the game plan. That's sort of one of the things that we don't really have quite like Modern does, where we are not a turn four format. We're similar to that in that the game's usually decided somewhere between turn four and turn six or seven, right? in somewhere in that range, it's usually this is probably going to be the person who wins unless the other person pulls out something pretty amazing. So yeah, I would definitely say it's a lot looser than a lot of other formats in terms of when that moment is decided. But yeah, I would definitely say, at least for myself, that when I start seeing, like, I've put Tron together, I'm starting to find the pieces of the wall combo. I'm starting to do just extremely powerful things in an iterative way where I say, okay, well, I have the wall down, I have the flicker in hand, and now I can... There are 15 different things I can do on my turn that are really good and that I can just dump my mana into the situation and it will be really strong. So that's sort of at least where I feel like, okay, we're good. We have control of the game and we can push from that. That's the stabilization point for me.
Yeah, usually your Mnemonic Wall is your stabilization point, and then Ghostly Flicker resolving on Mnemonic Wall is you have 1 point, you're beyond stabilized, you've actually won the game.
Have you ever run anything other than Wall in that slot? Like, I know Wall is my personal favorite just because it not only blocks so well, but it's so difficult to remove for a lot of cheap spells. Have you considered, like, with the advent of Blue-Black Delver, the whole Bolt being the most premium removal spell has kind of faded away a little bit. It's certainly, there's a lot more spells that can reach a little bit higher into that toughness bracket. Like, there's Galvanic Blast, there's Scred now, there's even, what's it called, Snuff Out, as sort of ways for these lean decks to kind of get a lot higher in terms of what they can really take out. Have you looked at all at looking at Archaeomancer as sort of a more low to the ground option for that slot at all?
Because not really, because of the mana constriction, the color mana. It's a whole lot easier to generate one extra colorless. And on that point, with removing your wall, you don't really care. A lot of the times you don't even go for the flicker on your wall until you're ready to win. Or you want to drag out that removal spell of your opponent. Simply because Pulse of Murasa, Mnemonic Wall, you sometimes actively want your wall to die, especially against Blue-Black Delver. I'll throw my wall underneath into Gurmag Angler so often because I want my Pulse of Murasa to be resolving and gaining me life.
Yeah, that's definitely... It's important to have a target that is not just a throwaway, right? Like, yeah, I can target that land, or I can target some card in my... Like, some creature card in my graveyard. But when it's something as impactful as a wall and that you're able to repetitively get that loop going, I think it's a lot more powerful than just casting Murasa, Pulse of Murasa, right? And I think that's sort of one of the things that people miss with that spell, is that it becomes sort of more than a sum of its parts kind of situation, where because you're casting Mnemonic Wall and because you're able to enter into that iterative gameplay style without even having to use your Ghostly Flicker, you sort of put yourself in a position where you're doing things that are broken in subtle ways, right?
Yeah, exactly. Pulse of Murasa is that unsung hero of Tron. Without that card, I do not think the any iteration similar to our current Innova Tron would be possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just comes in clutch against so many decks, right, that just says, I don't have to worry about things for a little bit because my life total is going to start bouncing up really quickly, right? It's just so much life in one spell that it's really difficult. Like, you know, you look at Burn, I'm never worried about playing against Burn. Unless they have a lightning fast hand that gets me dead incredibly quickly, I'm usually fine because I know at some point I'll find a Pulse of Murasa and they won't be able to beat it at that point.
Exactly. And further on that, your Mnemonic Walls die all the time. The closest recursion we get beyond Pulse of Murasa is, let's say, Reaping the Graves or Mortuary Mire. Neither of those really sound as exciting as get my wall back and gain 6 life. That 6 life is just such a huge swing in so many matchups that without it, I don't think the deck is viable.
No, it's definitely one of those things that just says, if I can do this a couple times, it's just such a kick to aggro decks that it's very difficult for them to come back from like 2 casts of Pulse, right? And it's not even that much mana to do that, right? It's like 6 mana to cast Pulse twice, plus whatever you're using to get it back, right? But it's just not expensive, it comes down very quickly, and it's very impactful in just so many different matchups that would normally be pretty bad for the deck. So beyond that, I kind of want to get into a little bit about what you are looking at in terms of playing Dendrovatron into a league versus a challenge versus like an FNM type event. I don't know if you play like proper paper Magic or anything like that, or whether or not you're an exclusively online guy, but does your approach to the deck, does your approach to how you play the deck vary at all between those different situations, or does it always kind of boil down to brass tacks Magic, this is how I play Dendrovatron in any situation?
So to start off with, I don't play paper Magic. Just lack of pauper community here. They play Legacy. They got money, I don't. So the difference between challenges and leagues, there is a small difference. In challenges, I know I'm going to be facing, on average, a higher caliber of player, which doesn't really change how I play, but it changes how much thought I put into the tournament. Because when I enter a league, I don't put much thought into it. I'm going to play Magic. I'm going to have fun, sure. When I enter a challenge, it's like, I want to win. I expect my players to be good. I expect them to punish me for my bad plays, so I'm going to approach it with a different mindset. As far as card choices, a lot of the times it's not too different. Like, I'll throw in one or two cards different just because leagues, it's a lot harder to predict what you're going to play against, so you usually play very safe sideboard options and very safe main deck options. But a challenge, you'll see me run silver bullets every once in a while if I feel confident in what I'm going to be playing against.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely what I've seen, at least from like your list specifically and other people's lists as well. Like when you're going to the challenge, you know you're going to be playing against some of the more top tier players. So I find you're sort of looking at how can I eke out those smaller advantages, right? In leagues, it's much more of I have no idea what I'm playing. I have no idea how good the person I'm sitting down against is, so I don't really have to worry so much about those small edges. But in the challenges, it's much more important to focus on that kind of thing.
Sure. I actually kind of want to talk about possible ban of Ghostly Flicker. We've seen it in the past. I don't really believe it's that oppressive. When you look at Pauper as a format, yes, Ghostly Flicker is incredibly unfun to play against, but I don't believe that's a contention point when you consider banning cards.
No, it's a competitive format, right? It's not about fun at that point.
While there is an argument that Ghostly Flicker is a very powerful card, I do not believe it's anything more powerful than Delver of Secrets or Augur of Bolas and stuff like that. I think it is very equal on power level to those cards. It just might be more unfun to play against.
I mean, there's no direct issue with the card being powerful, though, either, right? Like, we're allowed to have powerful cards. That's sort of one of the things people forget a little bit with Pauper, is that it's okay to have powerful cards in Pauper. That's not a problem. It's a problem when they are Drake and there's only two decks that are viable in the format at all, right? And I would definitely say that while the meta looks that way, a lot of people are kind of burning the Ghostly Flicker with, you know, the other targets for bannings these days. You know, it's anytime you have a conversation about it, it's like, well, we're gonna throw this one into the fire too because I had a nasty game against Tron earlier.
Exactly. When I hear discussions calling for banning more than one or two cards, I think you're wanting to ban these cards because you want a different format, not because they are oppressive. So if you're banning a single card, that's because it's creating a vacuum that stunts the growth of the format and stunts the ability to play the format. But if you're banning three or four cards, you are changing the format because you don't like the way it exists currently.
Yeah, there's definitely been a lot of articles that I've seen written by different people that are very much, I just want to shake the format to its core and see what happens, right? And it's like, that's cool, and I get the idea behind that kind of move, but it's not really what you should be doing with a banning, right? That's what Modern does when we're like, we're just going to ban out a top deck because we want to have a different Pro Tour format. That's fine for the Pro Tour, but we're not that kind of format, right? We're not the kind of format that needs to be shaken up for no reason. If something is too powerful, then definitely look at it, but don't just, yeah, we'll throw Tron in the bin just because it's been a deck for too long.
Exactly. I think in order for Wizards to take that action, they would be making a very powerful statement about their banning philosophy. And that would resonate beyond Pauper itself and be a pretty big deal, in my opinion.
Yeah, it would definitely be a paradigm shift for them. Like, it would be like, well, you know, this legacy deck's existed for 5 years, so we better ban something out of it to kind of shake things up, right? That's not really the kind of game I want to get into. That's sort of what got me out of Modern, because it was always that thought process of, I've spent $700 on a deck, and I have no idea if this year is going to be the year that they ban Scapeshift, or this year is going to be the year they ban Twin, and then it was. You know, and it's sort of one of those whole things of like, I don't necessarily worry from the investment angle nearly as much with Pauper, but if I've put the time into learning how to play a deck and it's not grossly overpowered and it's not consuming 20% of the meta or something like that, then there's really no reason you should be banning it just off on the face of it's been around for too long or the meta hasn't changed in a while, right? That's the kind of problem you should be fixing with card inclusions. That's the kind of problem you should be fixing with, hey, let's inject some powerful new red and green cards and try and push things a little bit away from blue, right? That kind of thing.
Exactly. And on that note, it's more than just your own deck. Pauper is a format that rewards knowing your opponent's deck as well as your own deck. So when you start banning large portions of decks to shake things up, it hurts veteran players like ourselves, where we know our opponent's deck, we know our own deck. And because of that, we have an upper hand on our opponent who just knows their deck. So if every 2 years the entire format gets shaken from its foundations, the players who have been faithful for the format stop getting rewarded and are put on a level playing field despite having put many more hours than your average Joe into a format.
Yeah, it really disincentivizes you to put any amount of time into a Pauper format. Like, if I can show up at a challenge after browsing a Goldfish page for 5 minutes and know exactly the same amount about the decks that are available as the average player in the game, what's the point? Like, why would I bother grinding leagues and getting matches in with it with my deck that I've been playing and stuff like that and get practice against the format, right? Why bother? Because next year it'll be different, and the year after that it'll be different, and so on, right? So unless you want to take sort of a eternal is standard type approach to the format, it's really not a very good plan to just shake things up for no reason.
Exactly. That's more or less my stance on it.
I think that's the stance of a lot of people in the community. There's certainly groups that have been calling for bannings lately, and that's fine. That's their prerogative. But I definitely think it would be a bit much to ban, you know, three cards at once or anything like that. You know, I think if you're ever banning more than one card, it better be a very serious problem with the format where I know these things are going to interact poorly, or we downshifted this thing and it breaks these three other things in different ways or something like that, right? You know, if we're looking at a ban related to storm cards and cantrips, right, and we make that kind of choice between we want to keep one thing so we have to ban these other ones, I think that's fine to kind of remove a bunch of cards that are in the same vein. But I don't think banning something like Gush, Ghostly Flicker, and all Monarch cards would be a particularly healthy way to push the format forward. So with that, I think we'll close out the show. If you want to plug where you can be found on like Twitch and stuff like that, we'll include all that stuff in the show notes as well, but you can definitely throw that in here.
Sure. So I stream fairly regularly. It changes every semester as I am a college student, but Sunday challenges have never changed, and I will always be playing those on my Twitch channel, Birdman263, and always be checking those MTG Goldfish links for Entropy, as that is my Moto username.
Yep, that's great. You can also obviously be found on the Discord server. You're a veteran member who's been around the block on there for quite some time, and we're happy to have you. So yeah, with that, I think we'll close out the show. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of The Edict. If you have any questions or comments, you can direct them to our email, paupermtgdiscord@protonmail.com. Or use our website's contact form at castleofcommons.com. Good night. Remember to keep it common.